This show was first broadcast on Free FM 89.0, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access radio station. For more information on our station and our wide range of programs, visit freefm.org.nz. The Access Internet Radio app is out now. Tune in to Free FM. Keep tabs on the latest podcast episodes to stream or download. Search our content by language or category. You can even check out our colleagues at 10 other New Zealand Community Access radio stations. Grab it now from Apple's App Store or Google Play, install, launch, and select Free FM from the stations listed. The Access Internet Radio app, your portal to Free FM's great independent community media content.
Hello and welcome again to Dharma Radio, where we're going through the graduated path of the Tibetan Gelugpa system. I hope you've had a great week, and those who were with us last week had a chance to think what it means to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. But before we continue, let's remember to take a look at our motivation for participating in the program again today. Motivation is so important in everything we do, as it is the motivation that makes the action what it is, positive or negative. The best motivation for any action is to gain enlightenment to benefit not only ourselves, but everyone else as well. Now, as I said last week, when we take refuge in Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, we have to know what those represent for us and whether they are in fact worthwhile objects to put our trust in. Most of us, before putting our trust in a bank to look after our money, will check out the banks to see which gives us the best return and conditions, not so. And if we're careful with where we keep our money, we should be even more careful where we put our spiritual trust. If the bank fails or invests our hard-earned savings in some dodgy subprime activities, we'll only lose some dollars and cents, and those can be recouped over time. But if we put our trust in a spiritual path that leads into the wilderness, we could find ourselves in a very uncomfortable situation for a much longer time than it takes to get our life savings back. So it's good to investigate the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha before we take refuge in them. Today I want to talk a little bit about our potential to become a Buddha, because not only do we need to know that becoming enlightened is possible for us, but we also need inspiration. And we'll learn a little more about what the Buddha actually is. The path is long and sometimes very difficult, but if we have a firm idea of where we are going and the benefits of going there, we will not be discouraged, but instead will work our way through the difficulties. The Buddha's enlightenment didn't only take one life. He practiced for countless lifetimes, giving his body wealth and possessions, keeping his morality pure, and avoiding harming any other beings. He also spent lifetimes practicing concentration and wisdom. Living in this way for life after life, he slowly developed his qualities until eventually they blossomed into enlightenment. At first, before all that practice, he was an ordinary being just like the most of us, going from one rebirth to another, driven by karma and afflictive emotions. Only when he saw how useless and painful it all was, did he decide to do something different. Everything that the Buddha had, we also have. There's no difference between ourselves as ordinary beings and the Buddha when he was a usual run-of-the-mill Joe Bloggs. We also have the same potential to become an enlightened being that the Buddha had. Even animals and insects have this potential. We all have what is called Buddha nature, this potential to attain Buddhahood. Some people say we already have the enlightened mind, but if that was true, we would not experience delusions and suffering. What we do have is the potential to become Buddha, because the nature of the mind in itself is pure. The deluded emotions are not an integral part of the mind, but adventitious, which means that they are outside the nature of the mind itself. You might understand this a bit better if we use a metaphor. The mind is like a mirror, and the delusions that cause our problems are like dirt on the mirror. The nature of the mirror itself is clear and able to reflect objects, and although it cannot reflect when totally covered in dirt, it still has the potential to do so. That is because the mirror and the dirt are not one thing. They're not of the same nature at all. But this is not obvious when we just glance at the dirt-caked mirror. It may seem to us that the mirror couldn't ever reflect anything. But if we washed the dirt from the mirror, it would become obvious that the mirror can. In the same way, by cleansing the mind of the obstructing delusions, its true nature of clarity and knowing will be revealed. The potential for enlightenment is realized by removing the obstructions to this very potential that has always been the actual nature of the mind. The obstructions are the delusions and their imprints on the mind. Similarly, we may compare the mind to water. The nature of water is clear, pure, and clean. However, if mixed and stirred up with mud, it temporarily loses its clarity. If the mud is allowed to settle, the clear nature of the water again appears because the mud and the water are not one. Likewise, the pure nature of the mind is obscured when it's stirred up or agitated with the mud of delusions. If we allow the mind to settle and become tranquil, the clarity and knowing that are its true nature will become apparent. That nature has always been there. It's not something that we have to invent, but it is hidden and obscured by the agitation of attachment, anger, and the other delusions. But those delusions are not one with the nature of the mind. Like the mud and the water, the delusions and the nature of the mind are separate. We can see this if we consider our day-to-day experience. Constantly the mind is changing under the influence of the delusions. One moment happy, the next angry, the next sad, and then again joyful. If the mind was the delusion, then it would not change. Once angry, for instance, it would always stay angry, and then enlightenment would be impossible. The pure nature of the mind is also like the sky. Birds, aeroplanes, and clouds may move through the sky, but they're not one with the sky, and though they may cause a temporary disturbance, once they're gone, the sky will again be clear and quiet. Like a wind will clear the sky of clouds, strong concentration can stop the disturbances of the afflictions and reveal the Buddha nature, free of negativities, that has always been the heritage of all beings. It is only the deluded emotions and their residues that prevent us from realizing the ultimate truth and attaining Buddhahood. So, through meditating and practicing, we can purify our mind of the delusions and their residues, and as our sufferings decrease, the pure nature of our mind will become clearer, like a precious jewel being polished. And because all beings have this potential, in due course, all beings will be enlightened. Buddha potential has two aspects, one that we have to develop, and the other, which is the very nature of the mind itself. The one we have to develop depends on whatever levels of compassion, tolerance, patience, concentration, and other virtuous minds we have at present. As we practice the path, we will have to develop these, in the same way a weightlifter develops his muscles until they reach their fullest potential. The natural potential is the lack of inherent existence of the virtuous minds. It is their very nature to be not independent, inherently existing phenomena, but to arise depending for their existence on other things. If these minds were independent and inherently existent, we would not be able to develop them, and so Buddhahood would be just a fairy tale. It's because our mind is free of inherent independent existence that we can become Buddhas. Our potential, when developed, becomes the Buddha's omniscient mind. It's a bit like mathematics. When we're in primary school, we perhaps know that 1 plus 1 equals 2. But if anyone asks us to differentiate 3x to the power 12 times 17y to the power 9 plus 23x to the power 4 minus 37y to the power 15 plus z, we wouldn't have a clue. By the time we're in our first year of university, such a differentiation would be easy. And by the time we were professor of mathematics at Oxford University, we would be able to manipulate just about any mathematical equation we wanted. Take that even further, and by the time we are Buddha, mathematics would no longer have any mystery for us, and we would be able to do with it whatever we wanted. Similarly, by the time we have developed ourselves to the point of Buddhahood, our efforts in concentration, wisdom, patience, compassion, and so on would have developed our minds to the point where nothing can overcome or escape them. When you have completely purified and developed the mind, you attain the four bodies of the Buddha. Now, these are called bodies, but they're not really bodies in the sense of our human body with its trunk, arms, legs, and so on. Perhaps the term body here might be understood more as thing, whether corporeal or not. As I explain, you may get an idea what I mean. The nature body really means the quality of lack of inherent, independent existence of the Buddha's mind. You see what I mean by body, not meaning quite what we normally expected. Mahayana practitioners call it the emptiness of the Buddha's mind, meaning that the Buddha's mind is empty of being something permanent, independent, and inherently existing, like you might imagine a creator God is. The Buddha mind is still dependent and impermanent, although it never again becomes the mind of an ordinary sentient being. You see, the Mahayana school says that the Buddha mind continues after death and continuously helps suffering sentient beings in various ways. Now, this could not be true if the Buddha mind was independent and permanent, because any functional thing has to change and so can't be permanent. If the Buddha mind functions to help beings, it must necessarily be impermanent, and then it's influenced by other things, so it's also dependent. Thus, it is empty of being permanent and independent. That emptiness is the Buddha's nature body. The emptiness itself is, however, permanent. It doesn't change moment by moment. So we can say that the nature body, which is the emptiness of the Buddha's mind of being inherently and independently existent, is itself permanent. This is a little difficult to grasp, but I hope you understand. This nature body is completely free from all the adventitious defilements of afflictive emotions like anger, pride, jealousy, attachment, and so on, as well as the resultant karma. Those defilements have been totally purified. So in that sense, the mind is completely pure. The result of that purity is that the Buddha no longer has any obstacles to being free of all suffering, because it is the defilements and karma that bring us problems. In other words, the Buddha is completely liberated. The nature body, like a clean, clear mirror, is also naturally pure, as I've described before. This natural purity has always been the nature of the mind, even before one attains Buddhahood. It has no origination, duration, or cessation. Remember, we said it is permanent. And because the Buddha's mind is omniscient, it pervades all things. And as the nature body is the nature of the Buddha's mind, it too pervades all things. The second body of the Buddha is the wisdom truth body. This means the omniscience of the Buddha mind that perceives how everything exists and how it appears to exist. You may have heard of the two truths, the ultimate truth and the conventional truth. This is just a convenient way to describe what is really beyond an ordinary being's understanding, but it serves its purpose. The conventional truth is how everything appears to us and operates in a conventional sort of way. We see something growing out of the ground with brown stalks, green leaves, and red flowers, and we agree to call it a rose bush. That is a conventional truth. The rose bush arises out of the conventions we adopt to communicate and make sense of our everyday world. But the way the rosebush exists is just a coming together of causes, conditions and parts, and the mind that labels rosebush. No real rosebush existing from its own side, inherently and independently, can be found at all, no matter how much we searched. That lack or emptiness of inherent independent existence from its own side is the ultimate truth of the rosebush. The Buddha mind sees simultaneously both the conventional and the ultimate modes of existence of all phenomena and is so not mistaken about them at all. For instance, when we look at the rosebush, it appears as if it really exists as an independent thing. It appears as if the rosebush has some kind of inherent existence as a rosebush. That incorrect view of the rosebush is the basis for us developing emotions, like attachment, aversion, and all the other defilements towards the rosebush. And that leads to actions that just create karma and so continue our suffering. Because the Buddha does not see things like this, he doesn't develop emotions or karma towards them, and is so free from the suffering that we keep creating. So that being able to see both the conventional and ultimate wisdoms in all things is what is called the Buddha's truth, wisdom, body, or omniscient mind. The Buddha's third body, the enjoyment body, is only postulated by the Mahayana tradition. It is a body of light and is usually depicted as a great lord and is very resplendent. If you've seen the tankas of deities in the Tibetan tradition, you will have seen representations of the Buddha's enjoyment body with a halo and so on. This body has the 32 major marks and 80 minor marks of an enlightened being and usually has a retinue of high bodhisattvas. Then the fourth body of the Buddha is the emanation body. An example of this is the actual body of Shakyamuni, who appeared to the people of this planet and helped many free themselves from suffering. Emanation bodies such as that are called supreme emanation bodies because they go through the 12 deeds of the Buddha and teach, guide, inspire, heal, and help sentient beings. Other types of emanation bodies are artisan emanation bodies that appear as people in ordinary situations to help beings. I heard a story about a very highly realized lama traveling with some of his students in a jeep in India some time ago. They passed through an Indian village where a crowd of people watched them go by. Among the crowd was a girl with a crippled leg. After they'd gone through the village, the lama told them to turn around and go back. They went back and stopped in the village, and the lama got out of the car and circumambulated the girl and paid respect to her. Later, when they had left the village, the lama told his students that the girl was an emanation of a Buddha. Now that is what is meant by an artisan emanation body. The Buddha can also emanate as an inanimate object to help beings, like a boat for someone drowning and so on, and that is called a birth emanation body. So I hope this gives you some idea of the way a Buddha comes about and appears. It's a matter of slowly developing the mind in positive ways and purifying it of all the obstructions and obstacles until it realizes its greatest potential. We can do this because the mind doesn't have a fixed independent nature. It is impermanent and dependent, so we can train it in any way we want to. The afflictions and karma are not one nature with the mind, and so they can be purified. And those are the very reasons why we have this potential to become a Buddha. Now let's have a look at the qualities of the Buddha's speech. It is said that if the Buddha was to give a teaching, people with different languages would simultaneously hear it in their own language and according to their own level of understanding. Even if a lot of people with different questions asked the Buddha their questions all at the same time, all would hear the answers in their own language simultaneously. Also, it is said that a Buddha's disciples can hear the teachings from either close by or far away. Now, I don't know whether this just applies to highly realized disciples or all disciples, because there is a story of the Arhat Moggallanaputra going to far distant realms to see if he could find a place he couldn't hear the Buddha when he was teaching, but he couldn't. Wherever he went, he could hear the teachings as if he was sitting in front of the Buddha himself. Another quality of a Buddha's teachings is that it pacifies disciples' minds. They relax, feel happy, and experience less delusions and mental agitation. I guess this applies mainly to people who are keen to hear the Buddha's teachings, for some, like his cousin Devadatta, were not pacified by Buddha Shakyamuni's teachings. Now, when talking of a Buddha's body, we've already said something about the qualities of the Buddha's mind. Other qualities are that the Buddha is able to concentrate on many things at once, like mental multitasking. An ordinary person can only concentrate properly on one thing at a time, and even then for some of us it's difficult. I have heard that women are better at concentrating on many things at once than men, but I don't know if this is true or just something women say because they claim to be better multitaskers than men. Anyway, as far as Buddhas are concerned, whether they are men or women, they are the best of all. One thing a Buddha knows that no one else can fathom is karma. Once a disciple of the Buddha said that he finally knew how karma worked, but the Buddha told him not to say that, as only Buddhas could see how karma worked. It is so intricate and subtle. For each situation, so many forces are at play, especially the karma of the beings involved, that it's very difficult to see how it all interrelates and works out to a result. Only the Buddha has the capacity to see down to the minutest detail all the karma involved and where the people involved are on their spiritual journey. We've been creating karma for countless lifetimes, so karma is a very vast and subtle subject, way beyond an ordinary person's limited mind to comprehend. Sometimes you may read in the Buddhist books that the Buddha has 10 powers and 4 fearlessnesses, in addition to all his other qualities. What we have said about karma relates to the 10 powers, the first of which is that a Buddha perceives clearly that negative karma is the source of all dissatisfaction and suffering, and positive karma is the cause for any happiness we may experience. We, of course, have been told this and try to keep to the law of cause and effect, but how many of us actually realize it completely? The second of the 10 powers is that a Buddha knows the cause of every result that a being experiences and when the cause was created. The Buddha also knows how all the inclinations of beings' minds work out. He knows what level they're at and what they're inclined to practice in their lives. So, for instance, he could see what religion someone is attracted to, even if it is not the religion of their family. He can see if a Buddhist has more liking for a Theravadan than a Mahayana way of life, and so on. And that is the third power. The fourth power is knowing how all universes are formed, their elements, and their states of existence. According to the Buddhist teachings, ours is not the only universe. There are a multitude of others. A Buddha's mind is in contact with all of them and knows them all intimately. A Buddha also sees the level of wisdom of each being and how much they are afflicted by delusions. Maybe on this earth we can get some inkling of how intelligent and wise the people we meet are in our interactions with them, but the Buddha knows precisely. He also knows all the paths to any particular goal, whether they are in cyclic existence or not. For instance, if you want to be born into a higher realm, rebirth, which is still a samsaric existence, the Buddha could tell you exactly what to practice to get there. Similarly, if you want to become an arhat, a Buddha will be able to clearly instruct you on what to do to attain that. Whatever you want to attain, even up to becoming a Buddha yourself, the Buddha knows exactly what you should do and can advise you. That is the sixth power. Then the seventh is that a Buddha knows how to deal with each of the delusions, how to oppose it, and how to end it. In fact, Shakyamuni taught how to counteract 84,000 delusions, so he knew every negative thought and the positive thoughts that were their antidotes. Included in this is that he knows about all the various concentrations, meditative absorptions, and so forth, and what kind of states they actually lead to, whether they lead to the form or formless realms, or whether they lead to liberation and Buddhahood. During his meditation under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya, Shakyamuni was able to look at all his and other beings' previous lives stretching back without beginning, and so the eighth power is that he can see all the lives of all the countless beings. Whoever appears before him, he would be able to tell where they were born, what happened to them according to their karma, how they died, and how they continued in their next life. Then the ninth power is that a Buddha knows how beings will die and where they will be reborn, and the final power and tenth power is that the Buddha can see where any given being's delusions will be extinguished. In other words, when that being will be liberated as an arhat or a Buddha. Does that give you some idea of the power of a Buddha? It seems pretty incredible, doesn't it? I mentioned the four fearlessnesses as well, so now let's take a look at those. If someone came to the Buddha and started arguing with him, perhaps saying his teachings were wrong, the Buddha would have no fear or doubt whatsoever in being able to assert four things. The first of these is that he has abandoned all obstructions. In other words, someone might accuse the Buddha of not being an enlightened being, that he still has delusions such as anger and attachment. They might say that the Buddha is not omniscient, he still has ignorance on his mind stream. A Buddha has no qualms at all about refuting such claims and proving that his opponent is wrong. Buddha is also completely certain that he has the realization of knowing all phenomena. One of the defining characteristics of a Buddha is that he knows both conventional and ultimate truths simultaneously. No other being has this ability. When arhats are in meditation, they will be able to see how things lack inherent independent existence. That is not just on an intellectual level, but that is how they will actually experience things. But when they come out of meditation, phenomena will again appear as though they have inherent existence. The arhats will not believe what they see, as they know experientially how things exist, but the appearance will still be there, like the appearance a magician conjures up. A magician will see the appearance, but will also know it's just an illusion, and so will not be taken in by it for a single second, even though the audience might think he has done something wonderful. Similarly, an arhat will see the appearance of conventional existence, but not be taken in by it at all, so will not react in ways we normally do, with attachment and so on. However, a Buddha looking at an object will see both the conventional way it exists and will also actually see how it is devoid of inherent existence, both at the same time. A bit, I suppose, like seeing how a rose appears as a rose to most people, but also really seeing how it's just a collection of ever-changing energy, both at the same time. To our limited minds, that might sound freaky, like someone on LSD. But enlightenment is much more powerful and a lot less dangerous than any hallucinatory drugs, though it's somewhat more difficult to get. The third argument the Buddha has no fear of losing is that desire, anger, and so on are the obstructions to liberation, and their subtle imprints are the obstructions to omniscience. If I was to ask you what keeps us in samsara, I hope you will answer the delusions like attachment and so on, and karma. When he became enlightened under the Bodhi tree, the Buddha saw quite clearly that the delusions caused all our problems, and once we were free of them, we would be free of suffering. Even if we have a huge accumulation of karma, without the delusions, none of it would be able to ripen, so we would not suffer. So the Buddha has no hesitation in asserting the delusions are the obstructions to liberation. Then, if we want to become fully enlightened Buddhas, we have to not only get rid of the delusions, but also the subtle stains they leave on the mind, and which ripen as karma. They're like veils obscuring our knowledge. Once we are completely have wiped those from our minds, nothing will be able to obstruct our wide-ranging knowledge about everything. That is how the Buddha became the all-knowing one. And so again, he has no hesitation or fear about refuting all arguments that is how to become enlightened. The last fearlessness is that the Buddha is able to accurately and with certainty show that the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Noble Path and so on, are the path to liberation and enlightenment, and he's supremely confident that he will defeat anyone that argues against it. The power of the Buddha's arguments and reasonings is obvious in many of his sutras. Sometimes his reasoning is so complex that it takes a really fine scholar to understand them. It shows that the Buddha cannot be defeated in debate. His mind is so subtle, clear, and wise that it will penetrate any fallacy or counter-argument and show it up for what it is. A Buddha has many other outstanding qualities, like each of his six consciousnesses can perceive all phenomena. That means that whereas your or my eye consciousness, for instance, can only see things, a Buddha's eye consciousness can recognize shapes, color, sounds, smells, tastes, tangible objects, and mental objects. So can all his other consciousnesses as well. But we don't have time to go into an extensive explanation here, so we'll leave it at that. Now we've run out of time. Once again, thank you for joining me. Please do so again next week, when we will continue our journey on the graduated path to enlightenment. Goodbye.
For more episodes of this Community Access Radio show, please visit freefm.org.nz. Thanks to New Zealand On Air for making this podcast possible by funding the Access Internet Radio Project.